Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 6:18 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is December 6th. Well, I thought we'd kick off today with crude oil. It broke downwards and was down over $3, but more importantly, it's closing below $80. You can see clearly that there was well-defined resistance around the $80 level in 2018 through to 2021. And the more back history we look at, the more well-defined that base formation looks. So then the other point, of course, is that $140 has been meaningful resistance on several occasions. Prices get up above 120 and don't generally tend to stay above that level for very long. And now prices are quickly reversing. And the magnitude of the move in oil prices from the lows in 2020 up to the peak is actually greater than the acceleration that we had leading up to the peak in 2008, and then subsequently that enormous decline. One thing that I think is especially interesting right now is that despite the fact that oil prices have dropped from 140, or let's even just say 120, to $80, that we have not seen a meaningful response from the energy sector, our stock market sector. So the energy spider is just starting to roll over. And in fact, it was up a tad in here today. But this is also in the region of a previous peak. Now, we're well shy of the excess of enthusiasm for energy that we had in 2008 because prices had been going up for 6 years. Whereas on this occasion, prices have been going up. And there is certainly a lot of people talking about a new secular bull market for energy, but I'm rather hesitant to think in those terms. Well, but there is, of course, a rationale behind it because people want to believe that there's a new secular bull market in energy because it's been the best performing sector by a long margin over the course of the last 2 years. If you look at the best performing stocks in the S&P 500 since the beginning of January 2021, the very best performer is Devon Energy. It has a startlingly similar pattern to XLE, and it's up over 300% since the beginning of January 21. But we had this massive reaction against the prevailing trend right around June. Then prices went straight back up again and retested the peak and didn't like it much up there. And in that intervening period, oil prices have been going down rather than up. Now, you might argue, well, it's not all about oil. Maybe we should address the fact that a lot of the energy companies produce a great deal of gas, and that's especially true of companies like Exxon and Shell. But it's also worth highlighting that natural gas prices are back below $6. And then again, if we look at more back history, well, we have lots of evidence that $6 is a pretty big psychological level. It's the upper side of the base formation that preceded after the big decline in 2008 and 9. So that's, I think, rather significant. And what we also have evidence of now is that prices are encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. So energy prices are coming down. That would suggest that this phenomenally impressive performance by oil companies isn't going to persist, and they're going to follow the market lower as well. Now, this is eerily similar to what we had in 2007. We can see that we had the big spike higher in 2007 in gas prices, in oil prices, and then let's just think about a company like BHP. So this was surging higher in 2008. And I got some of the most negative feedback for this service after my daughter was born in 2008. And that was in March of 2008. I said that I wasn't going to buy BHP for my second daughter, even though I bought it for my first, because I thought the price was a bit high. And I got some emails. I was basically accosted for being dishonest and for misrepresenting my views, and that how could I possibly be a bear of commodities or not into, and I wasn't even bearish. I just thought it was a bit expensive at the time. And then people were writing to me saying I was dishonest, I was a charlatan. And of course, that was a great example of mania, and it told us just how involved people were. And of course, it's also a product of an exceptionally choppy trend. The more you're rewarded for taking punishment, the harder it is to sell later. But it's also worth reminding ourselves that heading into the peak, that these commodity shares didn't reach their peak until May, June of 2008. I'm posting a speech given by Ben Bernanke to one of the Feds in June of 2008. And he's highlighting the fact that unemployment has just begun to rise, and that maybe risks are skewed to the downside, but that the Federal Reserve has the tools to bring things back under control. And he's highlighting that the housing market is a little weak. So that was in June, and obviously we had the crash in September, October. So when we hear central banks talking about their confidence that there's going to be a shallow recession, well, that's a guess. And they don't have any better idea of whether a recession is going to be shallow or not than anyone else. I'm not predicting there's going to be a very deep recession, but at the same time, I'm very skeptical that there's going to be a shallow recession. So I would give the benefit of the doubt to a deep recession, because what we're definitely seeing is that usually in the latter stages of a big bull market, you do get commodities doing exceptionally well, because the economic growth has not yet rolled over, and central banks are raising rates to combat inflation. So then investors think that this is a good place to be because spending hasn't rolled over yet, and there's all of these plans to build new stuff. And in 2008, it was really all about the rise of the global consumer and the urbanization of China and the fact that they were building a Manhattan-sized city every year. And now we're talking about the decarbonization of the global economy, the fact that copper demand is going to double in the next 7 or 8 years. There's a chronic shortage of new resources in response to that event. And these are exceptionally ambitious promises about the future. And on the assumption that demand is a constant with a constant growth rate, whereas demand is not a constant. Demand is volatile, but most particularly volatile at the end of big cycles. And we have an increasingly deep inversion of the yield curve. It's down now to 83 basis points. And this is at least as deep as it was in 2000 and in 1988 and 89. The most important point, though, is that there really are three phases to an inverted yield curve. There's the initial inversion, where people start to worry about the future, and you get a wobble. And then subsequently, people see that economic growth doesn't roll over immediately, and they go, well, you know, in the long run, everyone's dead, so we should be investing. So then you get a bounce. And we've had a good-sized bounce in October. And now, people are starting to wonder, well, golly, how inverted is this going to be? But the energy sector isn't really only just beginning to roll over. And then let's also consider banks. Well, Banks were the epicenter of risk last time around, and they're not the epicenter of risk this time. And that's because they have limited the number of risky activities that they're really involved in. But that hasn't stopped the index from pulling back. Now, a lot of the large cap companies have halved in value. But banks were really trending down in 2008. And they haven't started to really trend down yet, but this is meaningful resistance in the region of the 200-day and now 1,000-day moving averages. So it's certainly a warning. And when you have what would be considered to be pro-cyclical type companies rolling over, well, it suggests that the cycle is turning. And we have evidence of that already from the technology sector, the most levered portion of the technology sector has collapsed in 2022 and it's still weak. So I really think that there is the potential here that the ARK Innovation ETF is going to form a lengthy base, a type 3 base formation, and there's not a great deal of evidence yet to suggest that the low is in fact in. It could be quite possible that prices will come all the way back down to where they were in 2016, which would be another halving from 40 down to 20. Of course, that also helps to highlight the definition of a share that's down 90%. It's one that's down 80% and then halved. So there is obviously the clear potential that these riskier companies are going to endure further pain, because they don't have earnings and interest rates are still rising. So I'm going to post this chart in here today. And I think it's an interesting one. And it was a friend of Ian Little's had sent it through a few weeks ago. And I've been thinking quite a bit about it in terms of inflation. So it helps to highlight just how big the inflation problem was in the 1970s. And it puts into context where we are. We've definitely had a big pop on the upside in terms of inflation, and it has been really quite scary. And I think this is well understood that, and particularly by the Federal Reserve and also by the ECB and the Bank of England. They're clearly stating that they need to get inflation under control now because they're fully aware of what can happen when you get a wage price spiral and when inflationary expectations become unhinged. So therefore, in order to kill inflation now, then there has to be hard medicine. And that's exactly what we're seeing, that they're raising rates aggressively, the fastest pace of interest rate hikes in 40 years. So this is not going to this isn't a small impact on markets. The balance of probabilities has to be that there's going to be a significant drawdown. Now, Amazon, I think, is a really interesting company. So it has been an absolute darling of investors. And then we have this lengthy type 3 top formation, breakdown, distribution below the trend mean, resistance on repeated occasions below the 200-day moving average. Now the 200-day moving average is crossing down through the 1,000-day moving average for the first time in over a decade. So this is a really meaningful downtrend. They just announced they're going to fire 20,000 people. And at the same time, their label printing software has malfunctioned. We first reported it, or well, when I say we, I really mean Mrs. Tracy, reported that to Amazon on the first and has called to them every day since, and it is not fixed. She's already seen some of the best-selling products go to zero on Amazon, so completely out of inventory in the most important 3 weeks of the year. And in a retail operation, if you're not making money in the last month of the year, then that's basically where all your profit comes from. So this is going to be really problematic for a lot of Amazon sellers that want to replenish inventory, and most particularly in the home goods sector, because it's not just Christmas, but then you also have a boom in demand through to Valentine's Day. So this is going to be problematic for Amazon earnings in the fourth quarter. They're going to have a fourth quarter that's going to surprise on the downside simply because people can't get what they want from the marketplace in time. And that's only part of their issue. That's the online marketplace is a low margin business anyway. Then you have their cloud services, and cloud services are expensive. And subscription business models like cloud services, they work when you've got clients. And lots of those small companies, particularly those in the ARK Innovation ETF, well, they're the customers of these cloud database companies. So that's problematic. And Amazon's share is trending down. So this is a behemoth in the major indices that is rolling over in a really significant manner. So then there's an additional reason why the Federal Reserve is raising rates aggressively. It's because the duration of the federal debt, or the treasury debt in the USA, is very short, and it approximates about 5 years. Now, the UK, the treasury management of the UK made the right decision, and they stretched out the maturities of the debt. So, the duration, average duration of UK debt is well north of 12 years. And that puts the UK in a really quite beneficial position for managing its debt load over the long term. And that's also contributed to the pound's rebound. But then the question, of course, is going to be about inflation for the USA. They have to kill inflation now because the cost of servicing the debt has multiplied this year. It's up to $550 billion already. If inflation were to get out of control and surge like it did in the 1970s, then we'd be looking at the potential for the dollar to truly collapse, and also for significantly higher taxes, much lower services, and a real debt crisis for the USA. And there's no way they're going to let that happen, which really suggests that they're going to snuff out the asset price inflation. But of course, the challenge is that there's $2 trillion sitting in repo, and the Fed's balance sheet itself is over $8 trillion. So there's a ton of liquidity still sloshing around, and that's going to have to get taken out. So that would suggest that we're going to see a meaningful contraction in earnings. And I thought this was an interesting chart too. It's from Deutsche Bank. And it's highlighting where they think earnings are going to be. So it's around just on an earnings per share basis for the S&P 500, around 230 now, and they're estimating it's going to drop at least 10%. So you take earnings down by 10%, and then you're going to have a real deflationary shock. And bond yields will then compress quite significantly. And of course, the S&P is now rolling over in the region of the 200-day moving average. So with downward pressure on the dollar, gold prices have steadied up. But in the event that we get a significant asset price deflation, gold usually does best after those kinds of events, not during. So there is at least some risk here as prices test the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, I closed my long in the Hang Seng today because it is in the region of the 200-day moving average. It's the first area of potential resistance. There's been a lot of money printed in China, and efforts are certainly underway to support the property market and to get building going once more. And the renminbi has strengthened up over the last couple of weeks. But we're going to have to see continued support coming through from China to really move the needle, because there's 2 trillion of local currency debt that needs to be refinanced next year. And to really get the credit cycle moving in China again, then they're going to absolutely need property developers active and well capitalized. So there's a lot more cash needs to be plowed into the Chinese economy. And then they're betting on leniency in the COVID zero policy, giving way to somewhat better sentiment among the public. And they definitely need that money flowing around the economy once more. So China is certainly important to watch because it's a major source of additional new liquidity. But of course, then how easy will it be for that money to flow out? And will it help to support commodity prices? So the LME Metals Index has rebounded over the last few weeks, and it's now in the region of the 200-day moving average. And copper prices are steady-ish in the region of the 200-day moving average. So now the big question is, will China rescue the metal sector, or are we going to see a much deeper decline where manufacturing capacity in China will come under pressure because of falling external demand? And then will the Chinese government step in and really open up the floodgates in terms of spending? Those are really the big questions for 2023. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.